After being sent to Hawaii, as he had promised, I was taken out of the tank crew and transferred to battalion headquarters and made a battalion draftsman, and, as predicted, I did work on detached service with the Navy. As we had parted, I could not help thinking that these people from other planets seemed to know the past, present and future. Again he had sensed my thoughts and smiled, terminating the conversation with another handshake, and walked away. Most everything he had told me had already come true, except the contact he promised, and this I impatiently awaited, almost breathlessly. It was a strange, wonderful feeling, to meet these people. Somehow, as unimportant and weak as I felt in their presence, there was still the knowledge of kinship I couldn't help sensing. So it was that one early evening after work I did not hesitate to accede to a strong impulse to visit a section of cavern area a few miles away. I borrowed a jeep and took off. I didn't know exactly where I was going, excepting for the general area. It seemed I was being led. Near the caverns I stopped, then pulled the jeep off the bumpy, dirt road, and walked through the dense underbrush toward the caves. I knew I would meet one of the space people. Ordinarily I would have been fearful of being alone in such a wild place. But the thought of the meeting erased all of my natural apprehensions. Suddenly I halted as I saw a figure ahead of me. Through the underbrush I could see it was a female form. As I walked closer I discovered she was a beautiful woman with long dark hair and dark eyes. She was dressed in a sort of flowing outfit of pastel shades. Under a kind of flowing tunic, translucent and pinkish, she wore loosely fitted pajama-type pantaloons. She stood about 5'6", with the dark, wavy hair falling over her shoulders and the tunic floating gracefully around the shapely contour of her body. The warm, moist air of the tropical evening seemed to caress her finely molded features. I stopped in my tracks, staring at her in uncontrolled admiration, until she extended her hand and called out my name. Although I shall always remember the girl on the rock with a special kind of memory, this girl, too, exuded the same expression of spiritual love and deep understanding. Standing in her presence I was filled with awe and humility, but not without a strong physical attraction one finds impossible to allay when in the presence of these women. She immediately sensed that part of my feelings and also my embarrassment at knowing that she sensed them. "Oh, Howard," she almost chided, "it's only a natural thing, I feel it myself. It flows from you to me as from me to you." But many other men under similar circumstances would not react in the same gentlemanly manner as I did, she remarked, as I could detect an undercurrent of good humor jest in her words. Then she grew more serious. "That is one of the reasons you were chosen out of many thousands for contact with my people and the enlightenment you will consequently receive." Again she read my thoughts. "Oh, to be sure, Howard, if you weren't a gentleman, I would have the proper defense. So many people's egos are greater than their humility. But yours isn't." Again I was taken aback with amazement at the knowledge of these space people. "I know about the little Portuguese girl and what you did. It was a wonderful thing to do, Howard, and it showed you as the real man that you are. I am always sensitive to praise, though I deeply enjoy it." I shyly lowered my head and turned a bit red as usual. She referred to the little blonde girl on which some of my aggressive buddies tried to force their unruly attentions. Iard stepped in, suddenly brave enough to fight a mountain lion, managed to extricate the young woman and had taken her home. Her family had greatly appreciated the gesture and had received me into their family as an intimate friend. "In other words, I think you're passing, Howard. Isn't that the way you say it in school?" I was again overjoyed. I was so afraid that, feeling so powerless and inconsequential in the presence of these people, they would think me as inferior as I myself imagined. "You have been observed closely, as you now realize. You will be trusted and have further contacts." She also made predictions. Our outfit would go to Okinawa, would arrive there between April 1st, and 5th, 1945. My abhorrence of war she easily picked up telepathically. I know how you feel, and it is most admirable. You cannot think of killing a living soul. But yet you cannot understand why you yet help play such a role. You will be contacted on Okinawa, and you will be told much more about this. I hesitated to ask her if I might be killed, but it was on my mind. Oh no, don't worry, but be careful. You will have some narrow escapes. The average person with whom I talk about these contacts does not realize that the space people, though far superior to us physically, mentally and in spiritual developments, are still much like us. Often little gasps of amazement come when I tell of intimate conversations, and the warm humor of the visitors. They would probably stand sanctimoniously before the space people, afraid they might say or think something wrong, until, of course, they received the same feeling of ease I did immediately, even at the first meeting. At such a meeting one knows innately that one's every thought is bared under powerful telepathic observation. And with such knowledge one suddenly realizes he cannot hide anything, and becomes completely honest, both with himself and the visitors. It is a refreshing, cleansing feeling, which carries over into everyday dealings with one's fellow men. The conversation with the beautiful girl was so fascinating I hoped I hadn't annoyed her with too many questions. She was from a planet elsewhere in the galaxy. As to meeting her again, she wouldn't state firmly, instead she explained we might meet again, and I would have to know by my inner feelings whether it was really she. Suddenly I realized the sun had set, and as I looked toward the horizon, still bright with 100 shades of red, then back at her, she smiled, and extended her hand. We said goodbye and I walked back to the jeep. It was dark by the time I arrived back at camp. 4. A narrow escape. True to the girl's prediction, we landed on Okinawa the first week of April, 1945, and into a reign of horror she had charitably spared my anticipating. It is an indescribable feeling to board an LST and head for an enemy shore. As our small boat neared the beach, I steeled every nerve in my body, not knowing when the fury of enemy resistance would be unleashed. At that climactic moment the briefing we had just received on board ship held little comfort, but we hoped they were right. Our aircraft had given the island a saturation bombing of such thoroughness and intensity our officers believed that all organized surface resistance had been smashed. And even as we neared the beach our naval vessels riddled the island with concentrated shell fire. I had the feeling our landing had been too quiet. And I was right. The Japanese were still there, in force. They were really dug in, hide engine caverns and concealing themselves in outlying areas. If I had ever thought of war with the connecting glamour, that idea was soon gone. War on Okinawa was a grim, horrible thing, without a vestige of glamour, parading and glow some people may associate with it. This was guerrilla warfare, without any actual front, with hand-to-hand fighting. The Japanese had not lost their power to retaliate. One evening after a rather quiet day, our bombing and strafing planes were returning to the airstrip when a Navy Hellcat, the last plane in, flew in low, without attempting to land. Suddenly it opened fire on us. We hit the ground and took whatever cover we could find as it sprayed the area with machine gun fire. We were surprised and aghast. Had one of our own pilots gone mad? We later discovered a Japanese pilot had somehow gained control of one of our planes and had managed to slip in on us and make the daring attack, which did great damage. The enemy kept us constantly harassed by shelling us from a nearby island which they still held. The shelling did little real damage and was done, I suspected, mainly as a psychological weapon. One day as I was patrolling near the airstrip one of the shells fell short and hit pretty close to me. I heard it coming and flattened, and thought I had escaped injury. As I got to my feet I felt something stinging in my right eye. I put my hand to my eye and managed to pick out something with my fingers. It was a piece of shrapnel. I stumbled to the hospital area and received treatment, but the eye became infected and finally went blind. I was hospitalized in a large tent near the camp where busy doctors and nurses worked hard and skillfully at all hours, but they could not prevent the infection from spreading to my other eye. I was completely blind. Something happened in the hospital tent that I have often wondered about. Perhaps I can never be certain. During the first week there a kind, soft-spoken woman came to my bed, and began talking with me. When I asked her if she were a nurse, she didn't reply directly, but said she was not really assigned to my section. "You are one of the persons I have come to see." I detected a reluctance in her voice to tell me much about herself, and did not press any more questions. She must have known all a lot about me. She called me by name, though I figured she could have obtained that easily from the hospital records or the doctors in charge. She offered to write letters home for me, which I declined, not wishing my family to know I was hospitalized. When I returned home, I found that my wife had known almost the exact date I lost my sight. She had told her family, "I know what happened to Howard. He's blind." She assured me my sight would be restored, and, surely enough, it came back gradually. When I first saw my soft-spoken friend, I noted an attractive woman with wavy brown hair, dark eyes, and fine white teeth. She was dressed in an army nurse's uniform. Although I suspected she was one of the space people, she never made herself known directly. Near the time of my release, she said that I would soon meet a very interesting person. I assumed it would be another contact. I never saw her again after that day on which she said that. When I returned to camp, my buddies suggested that I apply for a Purple Heart and that by the point system could return home more quickly. I laughed and replied I certainly did not want any medals, and did not want to go home yet. While my buddies kidded me about not wanting to leave the pretty nurses I had met at the hospital, I smiled, knowing that I indeed had some unfinished business, but of a type they could never conceive or dream of. If my hunch I had about my pretty friend at the hospital was true, there was someone else on the island I had to meet. 2 weeks after my release from the hospital, I received an impulse to drive away from the camp, never anticipating what would really occur. Again I borrowed a jeep, my heart leaping in anticipation of another meeting I was certain would result. I drove along a dirt road toward the northern end of the island, passing deserted native villages which had been bombed and shelled almost out of existence. The road led down into a valley where the trees and shrubs were still intact, indicating there had not been much shelling. I drove off the road through the light shrubbery. Toward the hills I saw evidence of a number of caves. Closer inspection showed some of them had been dynamited to seal an unfortunate Japanese who had holed up there. About 500 feet off the road I stopped and for the first time was perplexed. The impulse had left me. It had been strong at the beginning, but now I was left without further mental instructions. At the same moment I was struck with the realization that it was growing dark. This time, as before, the impulse to drive away from the camp was attended with an unusual kind of bravery. But now I realized the spot I was in. I would probably lose my way if I tried going back. Then the remaining Japanese on the island were bolder after dark. My jeep might be attacked or a sniper might get me. I decided the best thing to do was to spend the night there. I unrolled my pack and pitched a tent. Finding a piece of wire nearby, I strung it in a square 10 feet away from the tent and about 1 foot above the ground. One end I attached over the tent, with my mess kit poised directly over my face, so that the slightest pressure on the wire would dislodge the contents of the kit onto my face and awaken me. After setting my crude but effective alarm system, I slipped off into sleep, while instructing myself that I must arise early enough to make my way back to camp before I was missed. I had not slept long when, with a clang, the mess kit came down in my face. I instinctively grabbed my carbine. Cautiously I peered out of my tent. It was a misty night, with a few overhanging clouds. I could barely discern a shadowy form moving around outside. Then my eyes became accustomed to the dark and I could see it was a large animal of some kind. I was greatly relieved. I figured it was likely one of the stray domestic animals from one of the deserted villages. So I reset my alarm and once again fell into a deep sleep. I must have slept for 2 hours when, bang! The mess kit again was in my face. Just as I reached for the carbine, a bayonet came down through the tent between my left arm and the gun. In a split second I had full cognizance of my precarious situation. I bolted out of the tent, and there over it was the hugest Japanese I had ever seen. He was so busy harpooning the tent, and what he hoped was me, that he did not see me emerge. I let him have it in the back of his head with the butt of the carbine, and he crumbled over the tent. Just then two others came at me with bayonets poised from a few feet away. Never before had I realized my strength and agility. I lurched toward them, grabbed the rifle from the one on my left, and it went off into the air. At almost the same moment I shoved the butt of my carbine into the face of the other one. It all happened so quickly that I actually collided into the one on the right and fell. As I stumbled, I rolled away from him, picked up his rifle and gave him a crashing blow on the head. He slumped to the ground with a groan. The other man took a shot at me, but missed me in the dark. I took a running dive at him. I was now unarmed. Dot with a quick, unexpected butt in the belly with my left knee, I managed to get his rifle away from him and then hit him over the head with it. Down he went in a heap like a sack of laundry. I thought I had killed all three of them, yet during the heat of the skirmish I was overpowered with the feeling that I must not shoot or stab them. I sat down for a moment, breathless at what had happened. I think I cried unashamedly because I feared I had killed three human beings. After I calmed down, I rolled the first Japanese off the tent, got my gear together and left. I found my way back to camp without incident, and not until then did I realize what a narrow escape I had. It was fortunate that the three Japanese were very large, and I noticed that these larger men were not as quick on their feet as the smaller soldiers. As I was about to credit myself with the remainder of the victory, I suddenly thought of the meetings I had experienced. Then I realized that I probably had a great deal of help, and very capable help indeed. 5. A prediction. Back at camp the very next night I awoke with a start. A voice called to me. I thought it must be one of my buddies. The voice called out, "Howard," several times. I looked around. Everyone was asleep. The voice came again. "Howard." Then I realized it was the same inaudible kind of communication I had received at my second contact. Again I received a strong impulse to drive to the northern end of the island, and I dressed quickly and silently left the camp. The impulse again led me to the location I had been the night before. I got out of the jeep and walked toward one of the caves. Then I saw him, standing near the cavern entrance. I could make out in the moonlight that he was very tall and well built. I walked toward him. He must have purposefully stood in the light so that I could see that he was Caucasian, dressed in army khaki and unarmed. Even though the events of the previous night still cautioned me, I had no doubt from the first sight of him. I had the same warm, comforting feeling I had experienced at the previous meetings. When I was within speaking distance he smiled and said, "Hello, Howard." I returned the greeting. "I see you got my message and followed the mental directions all right this time. It's too bad about last night. Then you know what happened?" I asked unbelievably. He nodded. "I'd rather not talk about it," I told him. The horror of having killed three human beings whose bodies were probably nearby, made me feel uneasy and disturbed. "Yes, of course I know, and understand," he assured me. "In fact I know more things that you have done and will do than you realize. We know more about your people on Earth than your people know about themselves. That's how I can understand why you don't want to talk about the incident." He sat on rock and indicated that I sit by him. "You see, My brother, he continued, this experience was necessary, as you shall later discover. If you had known of these contacts and the message we bring sooner, you would not have entered the army with the purpose of killing your fellow man. Knowing of your reluctance to kill a human being, we thought it best for you to go into the army as a regular GI, because you would thus be a better contact for us. Then I began understanding why it had been necessary for me to go to war. If you had been aware of the complete futility of killing others in wars, you would not have gone into the army and probably would have been imprisoned as a conscientious objector. I was beginning to see that these people were as realistically practical as they were highly developed spiritually. Such record would not have been good background for the job you are yet to do. People would look upon this background as unpatriotic and would not listen to you. My friend then told me that contacts are chosen on the basis of what the individual is like deep down inside, what he will do under duress and in extreme emergency, whether he would rather kill or be killed. Actually, Howard, there is no death. Only the physical body, or the shell, dies, and even that is not really destroyed. The soul lives on eternally, learning by its mistakes, always progressing. The good that is done is accredited to that soul. The mistakes are forgotten. I asked him his name so that I could address him. His answer was simple: names are not very important. The chain of events had been so unusual that I had often wondered if I were only having a dream. I asked him if what I was experiencing was really true. Am I losing my mind, or is it really possible that I am contacting people from other planets? For the first time, my friend was amused, but sympathetic. Yes, you have been contacted by people from other worlds and you are not losing your mind. Then with an almost confidential, but humorous tone, he added, if you think you're crazy now, Howard, wait until you see some of the other things that are going to happen to you. He told me my country would win the war. Without the aid of the United States, Britain and Russia would have been conquered by the Germans, who are far ahead in technical and scientific skills, and, he paused, you are yet to learn many things about their developments. They have used this knowledge for destruction rather than for peace in your world. The Japanese will surrender shortly, for they are about to be blasted into submission by a power which will shock the world, both in amazement and insensibility. It will be a more infamous kind of destruction than occurred at Pearl Harbor, far, far more infamous. This same power, he explained, would be used partly for peaceful purposes by governments of the world, but mainly for defense. It was the latter use which he said could lead to the destruction of the entire planet. Remember that the murdering of one man or mass destruction is one and the same. Evil is not gauged by the magnitude of the crime. The evil intent which goes against our infinite Father's laws will turn the same laws against your people. However, our infinite Father does not punish, destroy, or put any discomforts in our way. Man himself creates such, and blames God for his own discomforts. He even asks the Creator to punish others for their wrongdoings. He paused, and I was ready to ask a rather selfish question, considering the magnitude of the instruction I was receiving. Like the others, he anticipated my question. Nevertheless, Howard, the war will be over soon and you will be home by Christmas. He then told me other men on the island had been contacted, but that none of them knew the others and each kept the secret. Be calm and steady yourself, Howard. We have been spending a lot of time conditioning you and preparing you for your work to come. We are contacting people all over the world. He said that something very shocking would occur soon which would shake the world from its lethargy and raise it from the shadows of ignorance into the light of awareness and understanding. But this great event would not come without much misunderstanding, resentment and hatred. Nevertheless, we can learn only through mistakes, he reiterated. Man must learn what he is, where he came from, and what his real purpose is here on this planet. He told me I would be further enlightened as to my true mission, and as I listened I inwardly felt I had begun to know what that purpose was. Not everyone comes into the realization of this, But the ones who have been contacted are aware of the true purpose of mankind. He moved, as if he were rising, then paused. I have almost forgotten, Howard, that you are likely very curious about many things, more about us, for instance. You're free to ask, you know. Certain things we cannot reveal to you at this time, but I'll do my best to answer your questions. Relaxing a bit, I put to him some of the questions I was almost afraid to ask earlier. He was from one of the main civilizations to help out Earth, he replied to my most eager question. But how do you come here? In a ship. A ship unlike anything you have ever dreamed of. The force will be difficult and probably impossible for you to understand. It is an electromagnetic force, not unlike the force which holds planets, suns, and even entire galaxies in their orbits. This force is a natural law, which has been given to us by our infinite creator to be used for good purposes. But why have not our own scientists discovered this power? Ah, but they have. Yet they do not know how to apply it. If they did know the secret, they probably would use it for destructive purposes. Until they are ready to utilize it for peaceful ends, our infinite creator will prevent their understanding it. We talked for what seemed to be but a short time. Later I realized it had been more than an hour. Finally he arose. We must end this discussion, and I will say goodbye to you, my friend, he said softly as he extended his hand and smiled. Will I see you again? No, I'm afraid I'm done with you, and I'm sorry, because I like you. But you will meet others who will continue this instruction. Your contacts will become more frequent back in the States. We have much work to do on your planet among your people, and we must do it quickly, while there is still a planet and people to work with. He turned as if to leave, then halted and addressed me once again. You will wonder what I meant by that last remark about danger to your planet. Very shortly you will know to what I referred. I left the area, somewhat confused and disturbed. I could not believe that conditions were so serious on our planet. A few days later someone pressed a button and fiery hell fell on Hiroshima. 6. Back to the States we left Okinawa in late October and boarded a ship for Korea. From there, where I stayed a very short time, we shipped out for the States. I arrived on the West Coast about the middle of December, 1945, and wasted no time boarding a train east. My wife and I and our small son enjoyed a wonderful Christmas that year in the homes of our parents. After the holidays I found a house for my small family near Washington, NJ, and we moved there. Like most other young men, I looked at civilian life almost fearfully. For the first time I faced the responsibility of providing for a family in a changed world. I considered several jobs, but couldn't decide which to make my livelihood. In this period of readjustment and confusion, which was fortunately short, I don't remember thinking to any degree about my space contacts. Early one morning an idea struck me. I'm going into business for myself, I remember telling my wife. I possessed some skill as a sign painter. So I bought a second-hand truck and some equipment, rented a shop and soon was ready to do business. Altdorfi had fretted with various misgivings about going into business, soon I found a great deal of work, and noted, with gratification, that my customers liked the services. One day I realized I was doing very well, indeed. I had taken care of my debts incurred by going into business, and was putting a little money in the bank. My life had settled down to a normal pace and we were content. For the first time I found myself having time to think about the strange experiences I had encountered overseas, and again remembered that first wonderful meeting during childhood. It was in June, 1946, when I again received a very strong impulse to return to the enchanted area of my boyhood. I drove to my parents' home in High Bridge, got out of the truck, and headed for the wooded area remembered so well. As I walked, I began wondering about my experiences and caught myself doubting that the events actually had occurred. Somehow, The war, and the unfamiliar places I had been, now seemed unreal, as if it had been a movie I had attended the night before and then found myself back in the world of reality. For a moment I even wished it were so. I had a good business, a family, and for the first time in my life was content.